Support for Longform this week comes from listening. If you've ever had to rip through a huge pile of academic papers, you know how painful it can be to spend all that time staring at a piece of paper. Listening makes it really simple to convert anything you have to read into spoken words that you can enjoy on the go. Uses AI to generate realistic voices that sound like actual human beings. Plus, it comes with a powerful set of tools that allows you to do stuff like skip over non-essential text, but also take notes with one click. Your life just got a lot easier. Normally, you'd get a 2-week free trial, but listeners of Longform get a whole month free. Go to listening.com/longform or use code Longform at checkout.
Your body is unique. So why would you settle for a weight loss plan that's one size fits all? Noom is the weight management program that takes into account your biology to build a custom plan just for you. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com and check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer here with Evan Ratliff and Max Linsky. They are my co-hosts on this, the Longform Podcast.
Hey, good to see you guys.
Big hey from Aaron.
Yeah.
A lot of enthusiasm.
Very enthusiastic about the show we have for you this week. I talked to Alzo Slade, who is a correspondent for Vice News' show, which is on Showtime. He's also the host of a podcast called Cheat. And he is also a former, or actually continues to be, a stand-up comedian. So I guess my inspiration for this episode, other than just enjoying his work, I like to talk to people who come from different backgrounds to journalism. This was not his predefined career path, yet he has slid into it very effectively, in my opinion. And I wanted to talk to him about how all of these different pursuits came together, what it's like putting together stories on video, which is actually something we have not touched on all that much on this show, and probably not going away. I think video is here to stay, guys. What do you think?
You think so? Aaron's prediction. Video here to stay.
I don't know. I got a lot of oddball predictions, but very good episode. Thanks to him. And of course, thanks to our friends over at Vox Media who help us make this show.
Now here's Aaron with Alzo Slade.
Welcome to the program, Alzo Slade.
What's up, man? What's cracking?
I like to talk to people on this show who have had like different paths that have led them into journalism and reporting. And you are a correspondent for Vice News, but I understand that you are also a stand-up comedian. So instead of asking you how you got into journalism, I'm going to flip it and ask you, how did you get into stand-up?
I got into stand-up the way many stand-ups get into the craft, you know. Like, I was one of the kids at the back of the bus, you know, roasting, you know, and getting roasted. You know, that's where I got my chops. Like, the kid in the back of the bus, the kid in the back of the classroom that is messing with everybody else while they're doing their work and you're not doing any work, or the work that you do is to the level of, like, C standards, you know what I'm saying? Just so you don't get in trouble. So, middle school, I was a class clown. High school, I was a class clown, and people in college my freshman year were like, man, you should get on stage and see if it can work, see what happens. And I would host talent shows my freshman and sophomore year in college, and you know, I was just having fun with it, never intended to make a career of it.
So if you weren't thinking that you'd make a career of stand-up, what were you thinking during that period that you wanted to do with your life?
So this is the thing, Aaron, like when people ask me about my path to where I've arrived, it's different twists and turns with no intention of arriving where I am. right now. So while I was in college, I was in ROTC my freshman year. I watched Top Gun when I was in high school, and I was like, I'm going to be a fighter pilot. I wanted to be one of the Blue Angels flying F-18s in United States Marines. And so I was in ROTC in college, aviation guarantee, all of that. And my pops told me, he's like, son, you're not going to make it. You're not going to make it in the military. And I thought that odd coming from my dad, because he usually supported anything that I did as long as it was positive. And I consider that to be positive. He was like, no, son, I support you. I'm just letting you know I know you. And it's not going to work because you ask too many questions. You're too curious. Like, you want to know why. You're a thinker. And it's not to say that everybody in the military is not a thinker, but that's the trajectory of the conversation that, you know, he had with me. And I was like, nah, I'm going to be fine. I want to fly jets. Man, I get in the ROTC, and I'll never forget. This captain from the Navy came and did a lecture. He was a guest. He did a lecture. And the lecture was on blind obedience, Aaron. I was like, what? This dude said, if you're part, let's say you're part of a platoon, you marching, and then you see a cliff up ahead. If the leader does not give the command to divert from the path that you're going, you are to continue marching because you are to understand that he has the best interest of the mission at heart. I'm like, no, bro, not the mission. What about us? You know what I'm saying? And so the whole thing of blind obedience, I was like, I don't think this is going to work for me. Pops, you were right. And then I went in, started reading all these books because I went to HBCU, Prairie View A&M University, like one of the best decisions I ever made. And so it's like 98% black people there. And, you know, so you start to understand who you are as a black person in this world, black American in this country. And I started reading all the books, the Revolutionary 101 books, Aaron.
Tell me some of these books.
These are the books that are like, you know, Dr. Carter G. Woodson, Miseducation of the Negro, Dr. Naeem Akbar, Breaking the Chains of Psychological Slavery, you know, ISIS Papers. They came before all these books. And some of the books, most of the books, Stolen Legacy, George J. Like, these are the Revolutionary 101 books. And a lot of the books, they tell you black folks did everything. White folks ain't do nothing. And if white folks say they did something, it's because they stole it from black people. Now, some of that narrative may have some truth in it. You know what I'm saying? But I was like, you know, there's no zealot like a convert, right? And so I read all these books, and I'm like, everybody needs to know this. I'm like, you know, I started with rocking the dashikis, the black fist around my neck, all of that. Grew my hair out. And I was like, I want people to know about this. And so I switched my major to history and communications. I was like, I'm going to write and direct historical films and documents because people need to know about this. And then I said, wait a minute. A lot of these books are legit, but some of them, I don't know. They, you know, because when you read books, you want to learn more about where they get their information from. And so I'm like, wait, some of these books don't have a bibliography, no works cited, no footnotes. I'm like, where the hell y'all getting this information from? And Aaron, it was that time where I recognized I wanted to develop my intellect and put the class clown component on the back burner. And I was like, a real scholar who's interested in intellectual development should be interested in a disinterested way, you know, where there's no bias. It's like where you seek truth. And even if that truth contradicts what you consider to have been truth before, you have to be willing to swallow your pride and accept the thing that you have learned that may not be what you wanted to hear. You know what I'm saying? Because before I was reading books. I find myself on a trajectory of reading books that confirmed what I wanted to believe. And that's not true intellectual development. And so I went to graduate school to study philosophy to see if I could hang with the big boys. And you put philosophy with comedy, and both of those things are crafts in which you study human behavior and comment on it and raise questions. And next thing you know, I'm sitting here talking to a cool ass dude on this cool ass podcast.
Okay, well, I got to ask some questions about along the way. I'm actually curious about, you know, as you were having those sort of revelations internally and you're going to like HBCU, like what were the discussions like you had like with other students? Did you feel like there was like pushback when you sort of fell out with these books or fell out with those ideas?
One of the amazing things about going to a university like that, like Prairie View A&M University, it's a safe place to explore those ideas. And I think that's what college should be, with indifference of it being a HBCU or a predominantly white institution. Like as a young person, you're in the nascent stages of exploring who you are as an adult, you know, as a young adult. And so you should have the freedom to engage with ideas and feel like it's okay to be wrong in your opinions, you know? And so when, you know, I'm reading these books, I found, you know, my roommate was like-minded. And I started to recognize that there are a number of my fellow students who had questions around these things, but didn't necessarily have the answers, you know? And so I started this discussion group called Mental Calisthenics. And we put the chairs in a circle and start talking about history, politics, philosophy, religion. And religion is deeply rooted in the Black community. And so when you start talking about some of this stuff, it ruffles feathers, you know, you get emotional. You start talking about the way, you know, because you're challenging the way that people were raised, the way we were raised. I don't want to say people at third person because, I, you know, this is stuff that's woven into the fabric of my identity as well. So to answer your question directly, it was received, but there was tension. But we all know there is no change without friction. And so in order for us to unlearn some of the things that are detrimental to us as individuals and as a community, you know, it's going to be some heat.
When you started trying to put those ideas into some kind of a format, whether it's stand up or I don't know what other kinds of like media you tried out, like what was it like sort of taking in a bunch of reading and then trying to express yourself publicly for the first times?
Well, you know, I was well into my adulthood before I really translated any of that into comedic form. I think at that time, the expression of those ideas was in the format of, you know, conversations, you know, panel discussions. Like in college, I held a program called Negativity, N-I-G-G-A-tivity. And it was, you know, about mental enslavement. And, you know, I got pushback from that, but it was standing room only. And so during that time, my comedic side was just with the homies clowning. And then when I was in the environment in which I would express some of the things that I was reading or in these discussions, that really wasn't a part of it. Like I wasn't in there making jokes about the stuff that I was reading. I made, you know, joke at the top of a conversation or a program to kind of break the ice and loosen things up. But once we got in it and rolled our sleeves up, we're about that action, talking about the business of how we came to think what we think and be who we have become.
And what brought you to Vice News as a correspondent? How did that happen?
Yo, it's funny because I have managers, dude, like two managers that are really great. They look out for me. And Vice was looking to expand their bench of correspondents. And the casting person at Vice had a relationship with my managers. And as I understand it, she was looking for a specific person that they represented, one or two specific people. And those people weren't available. And my manager said, well, those folks aren't available, but we think we got somebody that you'll like. And then they sent me in to do a screen test. And I don't come from journalism, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, I do a screen test and, you know, mock interviews. And then just like any other audition, when I leave, I just wipe my hands of it and don't think about it. Next thing you know, my manager said, hey, they like this screen test. They want to come in and talk to you, the exec. So I go in and I sit down with Josh and Madeline, who are the executive producers of Vice News Tonight. That was on HBO then. I didn't know who they were. I mean, I Googled them, you know what I'm saying? And then later on, I come to find out they're a big deal in journalism, you know? And I'm sitting in the conference room with them and we're just chopping it up, you know? And they're asking me about my interest. And I still, like, I don't recognize the gravity of who they are or what the conversation is. And even if I did, I'm not sure I'd care. And so, you know, as a grown man, you just go into these things and you just be you, you know, have a conversation. And then next thing you know, they're like, hey, we want to work with you. All right, let's do it.
Did you go through any kind of like journalism boot camp there as you geared
no,
up?
No, sir. Let me tell you what happened, Aaron. So I go in and I'm there for like maybe a week. Week and a half is buzzing, you know, and this is during the Kavanaugh hearings, and they're like buzzing, and then they have these meetings. I'm in these meetings, and they got, you know, they're talking about the hearing and how they want to cover it, and they're sending people all across the country to cover different aspects of this story, and I'm in my desk, and I'm trying to like sync, you know, and not be seen. I'm trying to sink into my seat and not be seen. And they're like, Alzo, we got to get you out in the field. We're going to send you to Nashville. And they sent me to Nashville, the Nashville airport. And my job was to talk to people in the airport because they have this big courtyard where there's a big TV and people were watching the hearings on the TV. So it was basically engaging in people that were in transit and waiting at the airport and asking them how they felt about the hearings and talking to people I can do. That, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm like my dad. Like, he doesn't meet strangers. So I grew up around that. We, you know, you're not afraid to just talk to people and engage them because people are cool. People are interesting. And so they just let me loose. And I'm just talking to a bunch of people in the airport. We, you know, people are serious. Some dude ended up crying because he couldn't believe what was happening to his democracy. One dude was funny. Another dude was, you know, a woman was, you know, like kind of carefree about it. And it was a lot of fun. And that was my first assignment. And that ended up getting the Emmy, bro.
Support for Longform this week comes from listening. If you find yourself behind the eight ball, needing to read a bunch of academic papers or journals or any kind of dense reading material, you might make your life a lot easier by checking out listening. It takes anything, articles, books, PDFs, and turns the text into spoken word that you can absorb no matter what you're doing. The app has lifelike AI voices complete with emotion and intonation that creates a realistic and pleasant listening experience. So I had to go into the city for some meetings. I needed to review some PDFs, threw them in there, listened to them on the way. It was both pleasant and I kind of forgot that I wasn't like listening to a professionally done audiobook or something. Like very quickly, the voices sounded totally natural and human to me. This listening app might just transform how you consume reading material, and you can give it a shot yourself risk-free. Now, normally you'd get a 2-week free trial, but listeners of Longform get a whole month free. Go to listening.com/longform or use the code longform at checkout. Listening. Your life just got a lot easier.
Most weight loss programs focus on restriction and inflexible routine, which is why most diets fail. But Noom isn't a diet. It's a weight management program that uses psychology and biology to help you develop healthy, sustainable habits. Noom believes that weight loss starts with the brain. And their daily lessons are tailored to help users understand the science behind food cravings and eating choices. Whether you want to lose weight, increase physical activity, meet a health goal, or simply change the way you think about food, Noom can help you build healthy habits while still enjoying your favorite foods. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com and check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
It's really clear in a lot of the segments. I should say full disclosure that my wife is an editor on this show, so I've seen a bunch of it. I've seen probably you must have done 100 segments now. It's like a pretty high volume game, and you pretty comfortable with a huge, huge variety of different people that you might encounter. Like, is that something that you feel like stand-up contributed to? Like, what are you thinking when you just engage someone and you're like, I just got to get them going here?
Aaron, bro, we ain't no different from each other. Like, human beings, we are the same, bro. Like, when you come out of the womb, listen, this is what you need, bro. You need to eat. You need to sleep. You need to pee. You need to shit. And when it comes to emotional needs, you need to feel loved. You need to feel, there's compassion. You need to feel significant and of value. And when it comes to the feeling of significance and feeling valued, I think that's where we start to get into trouble, because the same things that you hold of value, I may not in the same way. You know what I'm saying? And so if you nothing means anything intrinsically. Right? Like the American flag, right? It's made of nylon, it's three different colors, right? It's a piece of fabric. We give it meaning. And it's not to say we should or we shouldn't, but we give it meaning. And that meaning is important to a whole lot of people. But then there's some folks that look at it and it doesn't mean anything, right? But if I respect the fact that it means something to you, then we good. We're okay. The moment that I don't respect the meaning that you give to something is when we have problems. The moment that I don't respect that American flag that means so much to you because your grandfather fought for it is when we have problems. The moment that you get mad at me for not respecting the flag because what I see the flag represents is being detrimental to my community as a Black person, then that's where we have issues. And so if I can engage you and recognize the perspective from which you come and at least give you an entry level or human level of respect from the beginning, then the departure point for our engagement is a proper one as opposed to an antagonistic one.
Okay, I want to follow up on that, though. So I get if you're doing a piece, it's got some kind of recognizable American archetypes out there that you've encountered before. You're like, okay, I kind of know where I am, kind of know how these people, what their system of meaning is. But then you've also done pieces like you went to Dagestan, mm-hmm. and went to wrestling academy there, the kind of MMA factory.
Yeah, them jokers crazy.
Okay, so that's people who have very different senses of meaning, and there's a language barrier, and there's just a bunch of dudes wrestling 6 hours a day in this wrestling academy. So how do you seek out that same sort of system of values and meaning in a more foreign environment? What were those experiences like?
Well, I think, before even, it's not as if I go into every story trying to identify what means the most to you and how can I, but the root of every story that I do is curiosity. I just love to learn. And so producer comes to you and say, hey, Alzo, did you know that in the UFC, at the time, there are 35 Russian fighters and over 20 of them are from Dagestan, and they have a 90% win rate. You're like, what? What is it that they are feeding these boys over there to make them such good fighters? Like, what is it? What is their secret? I don't know. I'm curious. So let's go over there and see. And, you know, when people, you know, when you're curious about another one's culture or a hobby or a craft or whatever someone else is engaged in, and you go in with your guard down and they recognize that you just want to learn, you just want to understand, man, they open the door. And next thing you know, I'm training with these young boys and they kicking my ass.
So what kind of like a research, like how much time do you have to research one of these stories before you're like off the plane and video rolling?
Well, you know, what's crazy is I used to research, I'm talking about like every nook and cranny of a story that I was engaged in. But then I recognized that sometimes I would do myself a disservice that would indirectly be doing the audience a disservice, because nobody wants to watch a reporter who knows everything. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's some questions that I ask that, of course, I already know the answers to, and I want the audience to know those answers too, but I'm also a proxy for the audience. And so I want to know just enough to be prepared for what I'm about to do or who I'm about to talk to, but not so much to the point to where I'm not surprised, where I'm not learning, you know, because I want to be on this journey of discovery as well. You know what I'm saying? So, and the audience is tagging along with me. So it's my responsibility to be their eyes and ears and rebuttals in these conversations and in these situations.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. You know, on this show, we talk primarily to people who work in print. And in print, you can like do all your research and figure everything out and then like go back and pretend that you didn't know at the beginning of the article and that you're learning and kind of craft this whole thing. If you don't get this footage in Dagestan, you can't like go back later and fake it or anything like that. So like, no. Are you kind of thinking about where these bits will slot into a final product, or are you just like living in the moment in these situations?
Yeah, I mean, in pre-production, we try our best to create ways in which the audience can see. You know what I'm saying? Because it's a visual medium. It's TV. So we want to, like, when you're saying, what is the audience going to see when we're trying to convey this point? And so we'll set something up. So, like, in Dagestan, we may be in the wrestling academy, and the coach will say, hey, do you want to come see this? Well, we didn't plan for that, but yeah, I want to see whatever you want to show me. So on the way to going to see what you're showing me, let's have a conversation. And we tape the conversation. And next thing you know, he's introducing me to one of his, you know, promising students. And he's like, Alzo, did you bring your wrestling shoes? Yeah, I brought some wrestling shoes. Let's put them on. Let's go out to the mat. And so next thing you know, one thing leads to another and magic is made, so to speak.
You did a story, I think it's called Heirs Property.
Yeah.
So for people who are listening, go watch it. But it's sort of about these situations in which a large number of descendants end up owning a property that was maybe bought by their great-great-grandparents. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. There's this kind of underhanded business maneuver where a property developer will buy out a few of the people and then force a legal action in which they're able to buy up the property and kick the people who are living on it off the property.
And that's pretty good description.
Good description. Okay.
That excellent. That was a great description.
Hey, thank you.
Like you should write the clip notes to the piece.
Thank you. So that's one of those things where I'm like, well, that's fucked up, but what's the story? Like, how do you turn that into a visual story? So when you're like thinking about something like that, like how are you thinking about like dramatizing something like that when it comes to you?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I have to give a lot of credit to the producers that was on my team, Dave Mayers and Lyle Kendrick, you know, we worked hard to try and create a space where the audience could not only see what was happening, but even feel what was happening. And I think the key to making a story like that into a visual one is not me going on a journey. I mean, it's me going on a journey of discovery, but it's through the lens of these people who have been significantly affected by this loophole, you know, by this tragic situation. And so in those moments, I show up, I shut up, and I listen, you know, and we just allow the people, the characters to tell us about their journey. And while they're telling us about their journey, they're taking us to the places where the journey took them, you know? And so that piece got a lot of attention and won an award. And, you know, and people are quick to say, you know, congratulations. And, you know, of course, you accept those congratulatory notes with gratitude, but you recognize that this is a fucked up situation. You know what I'm saying? And you're grateful for bringing light to the situation, but you still feel for the people that you profiled that have been hurt. And I think, you know, and I'm sure I imagine there's a number of journalists that can relate to this, because a lot of the things that we cover are tragic situations. In this situation, though, as tragic as it was, and the aftermath of it, so many people, so many strangers since then to this day come up to me and just thank me for the story that we did, because after they got their family together and they figured their stuff out. They got all their ducks in a row and dotted their I's and crossed their T's to make sure that that couldn't happen to them. And so as much as it was tragic for the Lewis family, and it was, you know, their story has helped so many people.
Calling all female runners, it's time to lace up and join Team Milk. Since the 2022 New York City Marathon, Team Milk has sponsored female marathon runners nationwide, providing support and shining a spotlight on their unique stories, perseverance, and drive to go the distance. Why milk? Dairy milk is an excellent nutritional add for both marathon training and recovery. Milk contains 13 essential nutrients, including high-quality protein, making it a crucial component of a training diet. Plus, it's one of the best beverages for hydration, even better than water. The same electrolytes that are added to many of your favorite sports drinks are found naturally in milk. And in 2024, Team Milk is taking the next step to empower female runners by launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. Built to be accessible, empowering, and community-building, the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia, on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
When you were writing the voiceover parts of that piece, which I guess is probably there's producers, there's other people who are in, but in developing that voice where you have to say where you're becoming the narrator a bit, I guess I'm curious how much your own views contribute to a piece versus just kind of I got to tell people what happened when I went and talked to these people.
Yeah. It's still journalism, you know? So it's not an opinion piece. And in that respect, I present what it is that we feel like the audience needs to know in somewhat of an objective way. Obviously, you can't be 100% objective by virtue of what it is you include and what you don't, but as much as you can be objective, and that's it. As much as I'd like, I mean, there have been pieces where I've turned to camera and I just let go. And it doesn't make it, because that's not the place for it, you know. I'll give you an example. I covered the protests in Portland in 2020, and BLM protests and Antifa and all this. And we're out in the square, and hundreds of people. It's night. You got the smoke and the all of this, and they had the grandmothers out there with their signs and whatnot, and there were federal troops in these little windows of the federal building with rifles with rubber bullets, and they had federal troops lined up in front of the building. They had the ballistic batons and all of that, the tear gas, and bro, all of a sudden it was like hell broke loose, and they were just firing. They were just firing tear gas, ballistic batons, rubber bullets. I got shot twice. Cameraman got hit with tear gas. You know, we got our mask on. It's leaking through my mask. I'm coughing, and I'm seeing that they're shooting the grandmothers. Like, they're just firing into the crowd indiscriminately. These are federal troops. It was chaos. And I just, when we got to a distance where I could take my mask off, bro, I just looked in the camera, knowing that it probably wouldn't be used. I just looked in the camera and I was like, this is fucked up. I said, I don't care what side of the aisle you're on. I don't care if you red, blue, purple, gray, brown, fuchsia, black, white, tall, short, skinny, gay, straight, whatever. If you were here, you would know something about this shit ain't right. This ain't right. You can't necessarily put your finger on it, but these dudes, women looking like stormtroopers where I can't identify them, and they're just marching through the crowd, shooting indiscriminately. You got folks tearing up, crying and vomiting, and grandmothers on their ground getting pushed. I was like, man, no. Mm-mm. I just unleashed Aaron in the camera. I was like, mm-mm, this ain't right, bro. Right.
But that did not make the cut.
No.
What was the hardest thing, like, from the time that you are sitting there auditioning to the point where you're actually reporting these stories? What was the hardest, like, skill to pick up? What did you have to learn in order to be able to do it?
How offices work.
I think I still haven't picked up that skill.
Because this is the closest to a full-time job I've had since I was 24. You know what I'm saying? And so I work for myself from home and would do, you know, contract jobs and whatnot. And so when I would go into the office and there's someone slacking me, I didn't even know what Slack was, by the way. And someone is slacking me or Google chatting me, and they're like three rows away, two desks down, and I could look and see them. I just get up and walk over there and be like, bruh, I'm sitting right here. So legit, Aaron, that was the most difficult thing for me. I was like, to this day.
What kind of stories, like when you're coming up with your own concepts for stories, what kind of stuff appeals to you?
Usually the stuff that has some sort of philosophical undertone. Like, I usually gravitate towards stories around religion, or obviously, you know, stories that may affect the Black community or disenfranchised communities. But I really don't have a beat, though, you know? I don't have a beat. I never really wanted to have a beat. And so, as I said before, curiosity is what kind of drives me to do the stories that I do. So if I read something and I'm curious and I want to know more, I'm like, hey, could this be a story? Or producers come to me and they're like, Alzo, I thought you may find this interesting. And I say, you know what? You were right. Let's do it.
Do you think about doing other forms of nonfiction going forward in your life? Like starting off wanting to be a documentary filmmaker way back when, has this experience like led you to have other reportorial ambitions?
I mean, you know, you always kind of ask yourself, are there different ways in which I can find ways to communicate ideas to people? You know, is it doing, you know, because the work that I do at Vice is an amazing way to do it. You know, the people that I work with there are smart and they are forward thinking, and you know, I really enjoy what I do with them there. But then there's, you know, podcasts, right? Like you do podcasts. I was asked by a production company out of the UK if I'd be interested in hosting a podcast, and that was a little over a year ago, and I said yes, and it's been great. It's, you know, it's a podcast called Cheat, where we look at scandals throughout history and try to unpack them in a way where we ask the question, is it ever okay to break the rules?
Well, let's talk about that, because like I actually think very few people understand how one of these podcasts come together. Like most people who want to get into podcasting are like, oh, let's get some mics and me and my friend will talk about reality TV together, right? And it's like, yeah, okay, if you want to do something sort of more high production level, more organized, like with a studio, so they came to you and they're like, hey, like, do they have the whole concept for the show when they came to you?
Yeah, they pretty much had the concept, and they've been doing podcasts for quite some time. And so, you know, they had a machine already in place that could facilitate some of the things that need to be there for the production to work. And, you know, producers come in and they have ideas for episodes. And they were really adamant about wanting me to be a part of the process and not just the presenter. And so I appreciated that. And coming in, I had some ideas and I was new to podcasts then. So, you know, I didn't know what it is that you're referring to in terms of how much work it takes to put one of these things together, right? So you have to get the people that you're going to interview, right? And just as, you know, there's some crossover between how we work at Vice and this in terms of wrangling characters to help tell the story. Because you may have these one or two key people, and journalists can relate to this, and it's like, you got them, boom. And all of a sudden, they back out at the last minute. They're not concerned about your deadline. They're not concerned about the narrative structure that you put together that hinges upon their input, you know, and their participation. And so it's the same thing with podcasts. And so you're trying to tell a story about a scandal that happened in history, and there are only one or two people that could really tell it in the way that it is genuine. And so you get them on the phone. Let's say you do get them on the phone. And you get them, and you start to interview them, and then they're like, "Damn, these jokers are dry as wheat thins laying in the sun in July." You know what I'm saying?
Okay, so what do you do when you get a dry, boring person?
Oh man, I mean, if we include them at all, you know what I'm saying? Like if it's necessary that we include them, I think we just do our best to make the narrative component that much more interesting, you know, because it is, that means I have to earn my check when it's like that, you know. It's like, oh, also you gotta come in and finesse this in a way that keeps the audience interested, especially if, like you said, you have an expert and this is what they know, this is what they do, and this is what you want to hear. But the way they present it, they've been in the trenches for so long with it, they think they're presenting it in a way that's easy to understand. No, bro. I do not understand that jargon that you're, I do not under, and so as a presenter, as a narrator, it's my job to come after that and bring some context to it, bring some, like, to simplify it as much as I can, you know? And that's where, you know, that's where narrators and, you know, the presenters, you earn your money.
Alzo, thank you so much for this interview.
Thanks for having me, bro. It was fun.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Longform Podcast. Thanks to our editor, Seth Kelly, to our intern, Noelle Matier. Of course, thanks to my co-hosts, Evan Ratliff and Max Linsky. I'm Aaron Lammer, and we'll be back with another episode next week. Support for Longform this week came from Listening. Listening makes it easy to convert written text to pleasant audio tracks that you can take in no matter what you're doing. It offers AI voices that manage to express emotion and correctly pronounce complicated technical terms, all while sounding like actual human beings, not robots. The Listening app might just transform how you consume reading material, and you can give it a shot for yourself, risk-free. Normally, you'd get a 2-week free trial, but listeners of Longform get a whole month free. Go to listening.com/longform or use code LONGFORM at checkout. Listening. Your life just got a lot easier.